I'm a visual neurophysiologist, which means I try to figure out how we see by recording from neurons in the visual system. But I admit that artists and graphic designers and to some extent visualization people have done experiments to try to figure out how we see for a lot longer than us neurobiologists. And often works of art are great because they figure out important things about human perception. Now, of course, there are a lot of works of art that are important because they reveal things about human culture or human psychology, and I'm not going to talk about those things. They're important, but I work on low-level vision, so I'm going to talk about works of art that have revealed important things about how we see. And some of these things are so fundamental that you can understand them in terms of the underlying neurobiology. And just for you as visualization experts, if your visualization doesn't interface with the biology of your observer in an appropriate way, you might as well write it out in words or equations. So that's why maybe you might want to pay attention. So artists have known for a very long time that you can represent an image in the world by making a line drawing. And that seems so intuitively obvious that you have to think for a minute, why is that an insight? Of course you can make a line drawing to represent something in the world. We all do that. But if you think about it, there are no lines in the real world. There are contours and discontinuities, but not lines. And yet we represent contours and discontinuities with lines. Why is that? And a line drawing can be a perfectly good representation of something going on in the world. But if you think about it, now this is where I want the lights in the front high. The projectionist and I have worked on this really hard. What color are those lines? Come on, this isn't hard. What color is this screen? No, this screen, here, right? White. The screen is white, right? The lines are black. Now you know, this is a nice projector, but it can't project blackness, right? It only projects light. Therefore, the amount of light coming to your eye from those black lines has to be the same as the, if anything, it's more than the amount of light coming to your, because of scatter, than the amount of light coming to your eye from the white screen, right? So what is your visual system doing that makes the same amount of light look black in one case and white in the other? Well, it's a fundamental fact of our visual system that we are not interested in how much light is coming to our eye from any point in the visual scene. What we're interested in is contrast. And the way your visual system does this is by the way it responds to the pattern of light on the retina. So at the top, this is an experiment Steve Kuffler did. If you shine a spot of light on the retina in a particular spot, you get a barrage of little signals. Those are action potentials. That's what the cell does. If you make the spot bigger, you get an optimum response. But if you make the spot still bigger, you get a terrible response. So you're putting more light on the retina to a cell that responds to light, and it responds worse. And Steve Kuffler deduced that this is because retinal ganglion cells are organized in such a way that they're excited by light in the center, but inhibited by light in the immediate surround. I can tell you guys this, it's a difference of Gaussians that your retina calculates. So he deduced that it's excited in the center and inhibited by the surround. We call this center-surround antagonism. And just in case you don't believe me that your visual system is full of center-surround cells, do you see the little gray spots everywhere where you're not looking? Right? Okay, that's because the center-surround cells at the intersections get 4 bits of light in their inhibitory surround, but center-surround cells on the edges get only 2. So there's more inhibition at the intersection, so the little spots look kind of gray. There's a dynamic quality to this because the surround is one synapse later than the center, and so you can get this kind of twinkly pattern if you work with it. So the take-home message from my whole talk is going to be that vision is information processing, not image transmission. And I mean information processing in a Shannon sort of a way, real information processing. The point of your visual system is not to take a high-resolution image and project it somewhere up in your brain, because there is nobody up there to look at an image. It's all about extracting information at every step of visual information processing, and center surround is the first and most fundamental step in visual information processing. Why? Well, if you have an image that's white in one part of the field and dark in the other, center surround cells in the light part are not going to respond because their surrounds are inhibited. Center surround cells in the dark part are not going to respond because they're not excited. It's only cells at the discontinuity that are going to fire. They're essentially taking a derivative of the luminance profile. So why is that information processing? Well, all the information in an image is essentially at the discontinuities. And so it's like the difference between a TIFF file and a JPEG file. TIFF file takes up much more information because it tells you the value of every pixel in the image. A JPEG is an image compression algorithm. I'm telling you this right. A JPEG is an image compression algorithm that throws away all the stuff where nothing, all the parts of the image where nothing is happening, and it tells you where the discontinuities are and what's happening at the discontinuities. And your visual system does that at the very first step in visual information processing. And of course, a line drawing can be a very efficient way of conveying information. Center surround also solves a problem that artists have had to cope with for a very long time, which is that if you're dealing with a reflective medium, and I know you guys work with monitors, so you don't care, but listen anyway, okay? Which is that white pigment reflects only 20 times as much light as black pigment. But if you look out on the real world, you've got a 1,000-fold range of luminances. So how does the artist deal with the fact that he has to compress the luminance range in a painting? And artists have struggled with this for a very long time. If you take a photograph of something like this, I took this from a magazine. If you're sitting in the audience, you can see the guy next to you, right? And you can see the person lit up on the stage at the same time. But if you take a photograph of it, you lose all the dark stuff. Photographs, because they're reflective, have a limited range of luminances. So artists have tried to deal with this over the centuries. And I'm going to use the Virgin Mary. Such a strange audience to talk to the Virgin Mary about. To illustrate this, because for symbolic reasons, the Virgin Mary is always portrayed as wearing blue. And blue, we're not very sensitive to blue light. And so blue is dark. And you can see that this artist knows all about modulating lightness to get shape from shading, because you can see it in the angels. But you hardly have any luminance modulation in the Virgin Mary. Even in the 1300s, I went to the Vatican once, room after room after room of flat Virgin Marys and three-dimensional baby Jesuses, if you want to look at it that way. According to the art historians, the first guy to really get it right was Leonardo da Vinci. And what unlike most medieval artists, when the Renaissance came around, things started being homogeneous across the entire image without a Virgin Mary flat and a baby Jesus three-dimensional. And he got it three-dimensional they say he was the first guy to really get it right. But he couldn't have got it right because it's physically impossible to get it right. There would have been 1,000 times more light coming through that window than in the shadows. What he did was squish the apparent range of luminances so that it looked like he had a much broader range of luminances than he really did. And I think even better than Leonardo, I can say this here, was Ingres, who painted people in such a way that it was better than you could get with a photograph. So if you tried to take a photograph of a lady in a satin dress, you know you would lose the detail in the shade. You wouldn't get the shade. If I had a pointer, I wouldn't be wandering around, but you would lose the detail in the brocade in the shadow, right, if you took a photograph, or you'd glare out on the highlights on her dress. So he managed to figure out a way to go beyond reality. And that's one of the things I want to talk about now. What are the tricks that artists figured out that can make an image more effective than a veridical image at conveying some kind of information? So again, we're talking about center surround. I bet this looks to you like a gray disk that's shaded from light at the top to dark at the bottom. It's not. I made this. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Please remind me to give it back, because I don't want to steal it. So I hope this looks to you like a gray disc that's shaded from light at the top to dark at the bottom. It's not. I made this in Photoshop. The gray disc is homogeneous. It's the background that's shaded. Your center surround cells can't tell the difference between increasing light to the center or decreasing light to the surround. So if you can manipulate the luminances in a relative way, you can achieve what you want. And of course, artists know this. It's called countershading. The whitest white is always next to the darkest dark. Another thing that artists figured out is that color and luminance, and I'll define this in a second, can be treated independently. Picasso said, colors are only symbols. Reality is to be found in luminance alone. And what I mean by color and luminance, you don't have to think about cones. You can think about phosphors if you want. We have three of them, a short, middle, and long wavelength cone. We see color by comparing the activity in these different cone types. We see color on a monitor by having more red than green. We see luminance by adding them. So in an image like this, this is the color version, this is the luminance version. Color contrasts usually have a luminance contrast, but sometimes you can have color contrast that doesn't have luminance contrast. And neurobiologically, that's a very important distinction. And I think that artists, starting with the Impressionists, learn to manipulate these things independently. So in reality, they usually go together, but if you can manipulate the color and the luminance independently, you can achieve interesting effects. So this is Monet's Impression Sunrise. It was very unpopular when it was first painted. Now it is priceless. I once got a small grant from Harvard to go to Paris to measure the luminance in Impression Sunrise. The sun is really vibrant in this painting. It just seems to shimmer. It has a very peculiar bright quality. But if you measure the luminance in Impression Sunrise, you discover that to two significant digits, the sun is precisely the same luminance as the background. And I think it's this lack of luminance contrast that gives the sun this peculiar bright quality. So I think Monet tumbled to something when he used these particular color contrasts. And the underlying neurobiological basis for this is the subdivision of your visual system into a dorsal and ventral processing stream. So vision, light comes into your retina, it gets sent up to your primary visual cortex in these two parallel pathways, but then it splits into a dorsal stream and a ventral stream. And we know a lot about what these different parts of our visual system are for from neurology, especially from World War II, because they invented these high-speed bullets where you got very precise lesions in the brain if you didn't die. And people had surprisingly specific deficits when you have small lesions in parts of the brain. So when you have lesions in your ventral stream, you lose the ability to recognize objects. You get what's called an agnosia. So you can if you're shown an object, you can precisely copy it, you can grab it, you can manipulate it, but you can't say what it is. And you can lose the ability to recognize surprisingly specific classes of objects. Like you can lose the ability to recognize words and letters, or numbers, or man-made objects, or faces, that's prosopagnosia. Or color. So the fact that you can lose these abilities from a discrete brain lesion means that there are discrete parts of your brain that are responsible for processing and recognizing these kinds of objects. And what about the dorsal stream? So evolutionarily, this is the part of the visual system that we share with other mammals. So the part of our visual system that's responsible for seeing color and high-resolution object recognition is a primate-specific add-on to the basic mammalian visual system. So all this old stuff is the kind of visual system that a cat or a dog has, and I know you think your cat or your dog can recognize you, but frankly, they don't. They smell you, okay? So the dorsal stream is what all mammals can do. They can navigate through their environment. They can do coarse object recognition, but not the kind of fine, high-resolution object recognition that we primates are good at. So these are some drawings made by people who had lesions in their dorsal stream. So this is for, the dorsal stream is for positional information, spatial organization. So these are people who were asked to draw a bicycle, a cross, you know, and a clock. So these patients have all the bits of these objects right, but the bits are just not in the right place. So and these drawings look a little bit like cubist drawings, right? So I'm not going to try and claim that Picasso had a parietal lobe lesion, but what I'd like to suggest is that Picasso had cottoned on to the idea that our ability to recognize objects is position invariant. So we have templates for recognizing objects in our ventral stream, or associated with our ventral stream, but we recognize objects from all different kinds of points of view. And the positional information about the bits is carried in our dorsal stream. So he was, in a sense, separating the ventral and dorsal stream, the where versus the what stream. So we call this dorsal stream the where system. Some people call it the how system, for it's how you interact with your environment, and the what system, for recognizing objects. And what's important for what I'm going to say next is that the where system, being evolutionarily old, is, like the basic mammalian visual system, colorblind. So among mammals, forget birds, fish, and insects, among mammals, only primates have well-developed color vision. So all the other mammals see things in shades of gray. The bull, forget it. It's motion. Because it gets its... Yeah! Why did it do that? Oh. Well, we plugged it in. We plugged it into a power thing that isn't on. Come on, guys. Somebody help me find a power strip that's power. It's not lit up. Oh, I know why. It's me. I'm sorry. This is unplugged. My fault. I'm sorry. Now what do? I hit that and something will happen. Sorry, where was I? That completely flabbergasted me. Right, so we're going to talk about the effect of making things invisible to your where system. So artists have figured a lot of this stuff out. There we are. Ooh, good, okay. So if you can imagine, or don't have to imagine, if you have a red spot on a green background and you take a black and white photograph of it, we're just going to pretend that isn't happening, okay? Come on. There, good. If you take a black and white photograph of a red spot on a green background, you get a gray spot on a gray background. And you can manipulate the relative brightness of the red spot on the green background in such a way that it's invisible to a black and white photograph. That is equal luminance. And that's a key concept. Everybody got it? If you don't, I'll say it again in different words. And weird things happen at equal luminance. So here, we're not even using color, we're just using equal luminance. See how weird that spot looks in that spot? Something shimmery and nasty about it, it's equal luminance. Special things happen at equal luminance because things at equal luminance are invisible to your old, evolutionarily old where system. So I want to try to convince you that your ability to see depth, spatial organization, figure ground segregation are carried by a colorblind part of your visual system. Now, you look out on the world and it looks vividly three-dimensional. Now, I know the world is three-dimensional. I'm not going to deny that. But you are seeing this three-dimensionality using two flat retinal images. So in a sense, it's an illusion or it's a construct. Now don't think about it like a Cartesian theater in your brain, okay? Because you've got the same problem, there's nobody there to look at it. Your visual system computes distance and depth using a whole bunch of different cues because all it's got is these two flat retinal images. So your visual system uses relative motion, shading, perspective, occlusion, one thing in front of the other, and stereopsis, which I'll define later on, in order to calculate how far away things are. You know, it's not like sonar. You've got to use information to calculate distance and depth. Oh, right. Here's where we go to this computer. A visualization conference and my videos don't work. We want number one. Oh, thank you. Can we turn the lights down too? Perfect. Oh, it worked. I'm so happy. Now we want to turn the lights down. Beautiful. So, oh, they're all the same. I've never had it happen four at once. So, if I make these spots brighter than the background, this thing looks vividly three-dimensional. That's depth from relative motion, right? I hope it looks vividly three-dimensional. If it doesn't, close one eye. We'll talk about that later, okay? It's also ambiguous, which way it's rotating. Don't worry which way it's rotating. What I want you to think about is how three-dimensional does it look? And if I make the red spots darker than the background, it also looks three-dimensional, right? But if I try to make the spots exactly the same luminance as the background, doesn't it get sort of flat and squishy? And I make it, now it's three-dimensional and sort of flat and squishy. And then three-dimensional again. So I hope everybody got to see that get flat and squishy in the middle. Now if we could go back to my other slides, I'm going to, in secret, get the other video moving. No, I have to push four, right? I knew that. Yeah, I'm just trying to trick you. Where's my glasses? I lost them. Can somebody... Here, no, I found them. Okay, now, what I want you to do is look at this image, not with the... Put the glasses down, please. Not yet, okay? What I want you to do is think about how three-dimensional does this thing look. There are obviously a bunch of cues to depth here. And then I want you to close one eye and put the red lens over one eye, okay, over that eye, the open eye. And see if that thing doesn't look more three-dimensional when you introduce a luminance contrast by blocking the blue light. See, now people want the glasses. Nobody wanted them beforehand. Okay, put the glasses down. Did it look more three-dimensional when you introduced a luminance contrast?
No.
Good. Okay, here's another image. Don't you, not yet. Think about how three-dimensional does it look. There are a lot of cues to perspective. There's occlusion. And what is really going on in this image? Even if you're familiar with it, you kind of forget what's going on. And again, if you close one eye and look through the red lens, I hope this thing makes more sense. It looks more three-dimensional, and it makes more sense, right? Like, you get better figure ground segregation, better visual information processing when you introduce a luminance contrast. Okay, glasses down. Monet painted a whole bunch of versions of this cathedral in Rouen. It's all about depth from shading because it's a beige stone cathedral. And in most of the versions, you see nice three-dimensionality in the doorway and the rose window and so on. But in some of them, like this one that's from Boston at the MFA, it looks kind of flat and shimmery. And I think that's because he used, this is at sunset and the light's streaming directly in, so there is no luminance contrast. And I think he used colors that are equal luminant to get this weird shimmery quality. I think Lichtenstein was doing the same thing in this version. This is part of a series called the Rouen Cathedral. But you don't even see the cathedral until you close one eye and introduce a luminance contrast with the red lens, and there it is. All right, now. So if your ability to see shape from shading is carried by a colorblind part of your visual system, that is, you require luminance contrast in order to see shape from shading, the corollary is that it doesn't matter what the colors are. As long as the luminance is appropriate, you will see shape from shading. So I think that Matisse and Durin were playing with this. This is André Durin's portrait of Matisse. And if you knew Matisse, you would recognize him from this, even though he is a very strange color. And that's because although the colors are weird, the luminance is just right to give you the shape of his face. In Matisse's Lady in a Hat, the same thing is true. He's doing what Picasso said. He's using color symbolically, but the reality, the shape of her face, is there in the luminance alone. So now I want to try to convince you that your ability to see motion is carried by a colorblind part of your visual system. And I think, yeah, okay, I need this guy here, which has decided not to move. Well, there it goes. Can we have, the button, me, right, sorry, my fault, there we go. Now we do something magic in the back and something appears. So you're going to see these moving stripes. And you can cheat if you want and look at the center. And if you look, they're usually not this jumpy, but just live with it, okay? If you look at the center, you can tell that they're moving at the same speed. If I make the green brighter than the red, you see that they're moving at the same speed. If I make the green darker than the red, they're moving at the same speed. But I'll bet you I can get at least rid of that jumpy quality. So look kind of at that speaker over there. And I bet you'll see that the movement on the right is more vivid than the movement on the left when they're just about equal luminant, because your motion system sees this thing on the left as just homogeneous stripes. I mean, homogeneous gray, not stripes. So it's a suboptimal stimulus to your motion system. Now we want to go back to this one. If your ability to see motion is colorblind, your ability to see that something is not moving is colorblind. And I think that artists have figured out ways to get a sense of motion in a static image using equiluminance. So this is Monet's poppies. They're just about equiluminant with the grass. Your what system can see them, but your where system can't tell where they are, so they can seem to move in the breeze. Now, Monet didn't talk about his poppies moving in the breeze. The art historians did. So I don't know if Monet knew he was doing this. But I know that Mondrian knew he had achieved a sense of motion in this painting, Broadway Boogie Woogie, because that's what he called it. And the originals at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, it's about this big across, and it's absolutely nauseating the way it jumps around. And I think it jumps around because the yellow checks are highly visible to your what system, but they're invisible to your where system, so they can seem to jump around. Advertisers, graphic artists do this all the time. You cannot, oh, put the glasses down, come on. You cannot open Wired magazine without finding something that looks like this, right? Shimmery, jumpy, rather unpleasant to look at, but it catches your attention because it has this jumpy quality. That's something that advertisers like to do. It's also difficult to read, and I'm going to talk about that at the end. So just remember that, okay? The ability to get a sense of motion in a static image, like I know you guys can animate things, but you know, for a long time, artists couldn't do that. And so to get a sense of motion in a static image was really special. This is Poussin's Rape of the Sabine Women, and the longer you look at it, the more it looks like a bunch of statues. It just doesn't go anywhere. But the longer you look at Monet's paintings, the more you get this weird sense that something might be going on. And it seems to change as you move your eyes around. So what's going on? If you, down here in the water, he's got these little dabs of black, blue, white, and mustard. And people talk about how Monet's water moves. You could argue about that. But Aki Kitioka took it one step further, and he made black, blue, white, yellow things repeating, and you get this bizarre sense of motion. And I think this isn't so much an effect of equal luminance. What he did was use high and low contrast. So your visual system processes high contrast things faster than low contrast things. So if you look at an image where there's something high contrast next to something low contrast, it's like a marquee illusion. It's like something happened here and then it happened here. So it's almost like a fake animation. Here's another version. I find this a little less distressing than the earlier one. These stripes seem to move because you've got high contrast, low contrast. So it seems to go, which way does it go? This way and that way. So now I want to talk about depth and three-dimensionality. And I want to talk about the fact that your visual system computes things locally that are then used to make global percepts. So you might think about depth and three-dimensionality as something that you have to compute across the entire image. You know, perspective goes like this. You've got to use the whole image. Shading isn't local, it's like global. But it turns out that you start with local computations because you have small receptive fields early in your visual system, and you don't get the whole visual field until you get way, way up in the visual system, at which point the local cues can't be processed. So that means that it's not necessary for your image or your painting. You can violate the laws of physics if you want, and it doesn't bother anybody. So let me show you a few examples. Here's a painting where the shadows, I lost the button, there it is. The shadows are going this way and that way. It's very hard to manage that in a real life situation. Here's another painting in which you have light streaming through a window, making a very nice pattern of light on the wall, but you're somehow missing that bit. Again, you couldn't do that in real life. Artists have known for a very long time that things recede into the distance because of the projection pattern of light on the retina, so they can get pretty good feelings of three-dimensionality, but you don't have to observe the laws of optics because you can have vanishing points that go every which way in a painting and it doesn't bother you. And when you actually observe the laws of physics, it seems contrived, which is why you can have impossible figures. Escher likes these. The local depth cues are all fine, but globally they're inconsistent. Here's a painting I discovered that's just like a Penrose triangle, where if you're looking at the roof from the bottom here and from the top here. Couldn't do that, doesn't bother anybody. And Magritte liked to play with that. Even occlusion is local, and you can violate the global facts. Of course, Escher liked to play with these things. I like Escher. Here's one that I like. So Vermeer painted this nice brass bowl, and it looks shiny because it seems to be reflecting what's the tablecloth underneath it, but if you look closely, what it's reflecting has nothing to do with the tablecloth underneath it, but it still looks nice and shiny. Let's see. So now I've talked about the colorblind properties of the Ware system and the fact that the computations we make are local, not global. Now I want to talk about the fact that color is coarse, because the cells in your visual system that compute color have big, sloppy receptive fields. So these are the color cells, these are the contour cells. They're big, so you have low resolution. You don't have to color inside the lines. Here's an illusion based on that fact. I bet you this looks yellow here compared to the background here, right? It's not. I made this in Photoshop. This is a yellow line inside a blue line, and a yellow line inside a blue line. This is the same color as that. But the color, because your color resolution is so low, color spreads till it hits a border. So the yellow is inside the blue line here, so it spreads in that direction. See, I blew it up there. It's just two lines. Now I want to use after images to make some blurry colors so that you can watch your color spread till it hits a border. After images happen because the retinal neurons run out of juice, okay? It's not important. But I just want to make some after images. What I want you to do is look right at the intersection of these three shapes. Look real hard at the intersection so you get a nice crisp after image. And then I'm going to show you a homogeneous gray, and you're going to evaluate the after image, okay? So look at the intersection, and now evaluate the after image. Now, this is an achromatic image. Okay, it takes some time. Now, some of you are saying, oh, well, obviously the second one was better, but that's because you did it twice and we built it up. Let's go back and let's look at the intersection, evaluate the after image, look at the intersection, evaluate the after. It's better, right? Okay, here's another version. Look at the intersection and see if it bothers you that one of those shapes changed. And here's the last one. Look at the intersection and watch the colors squirt out the hole. The television industry knows that our color resolution is low, and so the old-fashioned kind of color TV took advantage of this, because the FTC, when television was first invented, it was black and white, and everybody got 6 megahertz of bandwidth to transmit their signal, which was just as much as you needed for the 535 by 485 pixels in a TV set. And then CBS got the great idea of transmitting 3 images, red, green, and blue, to different phosphors. And they said, could we please have 18 megahertz of bandwidth? And the FTC said, no, everybody gets 6 and that's it. And so CBS actually transmitted a very tiny TV image for a while, but nobody bought the TVs because they were little. And then RCA got the brilliant idea of dividing up the 6 megahertz into 4 megahertz worth of luminance signal and 2 megahertz worth of 2 color difference signals, low resolution, not as much bandwidth, and it doesn't bother you. And I don't care how much you guys like your HD TVs. Here's another issue that artists figured out that has about resolution. So the Mona Lisa is a really famous painting. And you may think this is kind of corny, but it really is an amazing painting. And I know you've seen it in postcards and 100 times, but if you look at this image, you will discover that her expression changes in a dynamic way that makes her seem alive. And I might blow it up just to make it easier. So if you look at this image and think about her expression, I want you first to look at her eyes. So look right at her eyes. You have to keep track of where your eyes are. Look at her eyes and think about how much she's smiling, and then look at her mouth and think about how much she's smiling. Look back and forth between her mouth and her eyes and see if you don't find that she changes expression systematically depending on where you're looking. Now, the art historians say that her expression changes dynamically because Leonardo used suffumato, that is, he made her mouth blurry. Therefore, it's ambiguous. It's left up to your imagination. But in my opinion, it's not your imagination that causes her smile to come and go. It's where you're looking. Does everybody see that? It comes and goes depending on where you're looking. So I, being a visual physiologist, I knew that my visual acuity falls off dramatically from my center of gaze. So if you look at that dot, all these letters are equally readable. Doesn't matter how far away you are, it scales. So your central vision, that's why you move your eyes when you read. Your central vision is really good at seeing little, tiny, high spatial frequency things. Your peripheral vision is better at seeing low spatial frequency things. So it's not that your peripheral vision's no good, it's that it's specialized for low spatial frequency and your central vision is high spatial frequency. You move your eyes around. That's why the world doesn't seem to be just high resolution in the center and blurry in the periphery, because you move your eyes around all the time. So if you filter the Mona Lisa in such a way that you see what she would look like to your peripheral vision compared to your central vision, of course you couldn't see the whole thing with your central vision all at once, but let's pretend, okay? And of course she seems much cheerier in this version than that version. I once went to Caltech and they asked me how I quantified that. Photomosaics have this same dynamic quality because what you see with your central vision, the individual images, is different from what you see with your peripheral vision. So as you move your eyes around, you see baseball cards with your central vision, you see Babe Ruth with your peripheral vision. So where am I? Oh, goody. Oh, it's 10 o'clock. How'd that happen? Is it 10 o'clock really? 10 till. Oh, good. Okay. I wanted to talk about object recognition. I want to talk about how we recognize objects, because this is something that we're working on now, and it's an interesting mystery. So again, get yourself away from the idea that vision is easy. Vision is information processing, and I don't want to insult you or anything, but it's really hard to make a computer that can recognize faces anywhere near as good as a human or a monkey. And artists have figured out part of what's going on in our visual system when they discovered that a caricature is much easier to recognize than a veridical line drawing of an individual. So this tells us something about the way we process faces. And we've been looking at how cells in the visual system of monkeys and humans process faces. And we did that by showing cartoon faces to cells in face-specific parts of the brain. Remember, I told you that faces are processed in a specific part of the brain. So what we did was we varied all the different parameters of a face fast and showed it to cells and recorded the activity of cells in response to images like this. And I hope you all agree that these faces go outside the realm of physical plausibility. But that's because we wanted to map face processing. And what we discovered is that, so you could imagine you have two ways of coding faces. We discovered, first of all, that we do code faces. So there are cells that like eye size and eye distance and mouth size and stuff like that. You could imagine that if you had a cell that was sensitive to inter-eye distance, that you might have a cell that was optimum for each possible inter-eye distance. Or you could have two cells, one that liked big inter-eye distance and one that liked small inter-eye distance. And that's kind of a more efficient way of coding things because all you need is the ratio of these two cells to get all of these possible values. Well, it turns out this is the way our brains do it. We code parameters by their extremes, and that's why caricatures work. So we recognize face. So I want you to adapt to some faces for a minute, because I want to show you that all of these parameters can adapt, just like a low-level vision can give you a... I want you to look at these five dots and try to listen to what I'm saying, okay? In low-level vision, you can adapt out one thing. That's why you get after images, right? But we're going to adapt out... Just keep looking at these red dots, okay? We're going to adapt out high-level feature recognition that is going to, if I can stall around long enough, I'm trying to stall around here, we're going to adapt out something as high-level as individual recognition. You're looking at me. Stop. Look at the five red dots, okay? Come on. All right, and what I'm going to do now, if you've finished looking at these five red dots, is you should have an after image now. These are identical images, okay? And yet you adapted out the identity of those two individuals so that they then look the opposite. Some of you got it. The rest of you were cheating. Artists figured this out. So I'm sure you've seen Picasso's drawings and know that they look a little weird. But it's interesting to compare some of his drawings and paintings to the people that they were of. So for example, this is Picasso himself. This is his dealer. No, that's a guy he lived with, his dealer, one of his girlfriend, one of his wives, another wife, his mother-in-law. And you can see that he really captures, in a sense, what each of these people, how they differ from the average. And so why is this important? Because it tells you about how we process and recognize objects, because you've got to somehow effectively represent who somebody is or what something is by the pattern of firing of neurons in your brain. And that means when you're extracting information, there are certain parts of that object that are more important than other parts. So if you ask a child, any child, three-year-old child, to draw a person, this is what you will invariably get. You will get a head with legs. What's the child telling you about how he actually represents in his brain who a person is? The face. The face is the first and most foremost bit of information that you have about who somebody is. Is the kids, so there's another kid who draws that. Sometimes after a few years they get bodies and so on. Here is some drawings by a child with autism. Severely retarded child who could draw horses beautifully. So this child is representing a lower level representation, which is more veridical. You might say this child is more artistic. But in another sense, this child isn't extracting what's important about the images and then reflecting them back. So there's this process that goes on when children learn to draw, where they draw what's in their head, but then they look at it and it's not what they wanted to draw. So it's, Picasso says it took him a lifetime to learn to draw like a child. What he was trying to do was extract what's real. Oh, this is about, we don't want to do transmagnetic cranial stimulation. We do. Well, yeah, I know, but then you won't get to coffee. All right. If you do TMS, which like knocks out part of your brain, if you knock out the higher level frontal lobe stuff, even totally unskilled people, see, these are unskilled adults, become, in a sense, more artistic when you knock out their higher level processing. Because what they're doing is accessing the lower level, more veridical representation. But I kind of think that the higher level stuff is more interesting. Because I used to, in emotions, again, we can learn from the computer community what these emotions are. They're so exaggerated, but yet that may be what's going on in our brains for representing these emotions. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is stereopsis. 5 minutes on stereopsis. Both eyes open, red on the left, blue on the right. That's stereopsis. Everybody got it? Sometimes it takes your eyes. If you're in the front row, forget it. You're too close. Okay, put the glasses down if you want. You know, I don't care this time. Stereopsis is depth from the difference in the images in your two eyes. So you have two eyes. They're horizontally offset by a few inches, which means that as you look out on the world, your images are slightly different in your two eyes. And your brain uses this information to help compute depth. So if you're focusing on an image in one plane, Objects that are not in the plane of fixation will cast images on non-corresponding parts of your retina, and your visual system uses that information. So if you're looking at a flat image, and the artist has gone to a lot of trouble to compute distance and depth using shading and perspective and occlusion, you stand in front of that painting with your two eyes open, and your stereo system says, nah, it's flat, sorry. So if you want to experience the three-dimensionality of all the monocular depth cues, close one eye. It will look more three-dimensional. And it helps if you're right in front of a painting and it fills your visual field. But you can get more depth in a flat image by closing one eye because you're canceling out the stereo information that it's flat. It doesn't even have to be a good image. But stereo matching is computationally a difficult problem. Now, this is a very smart audience. No, no glasses. If I tell you that the red is white to your right eye, no, the red is white to your left eye, the cyan is white to your right eye, can you figure out what this shows? It's a really, it's a simple algorithm. You're good at algorithms. No? Okay. Put on the stereo glasses, blue on the right, red on the left. Some of you, don't take it personally if you don't see this, blue on the right, will see something. If you don't see it, don't worry. You're among the 10% of otherwise normal people who do not have stereopsis. Don't take it personally, okay? I'll tell you why in a second. Okay, so some of you see something, right? But it's a very difficult matching problem. How does your visual system know that this white, this red dot in your right eye matches up this one with this one? I mean, you could just as easily mismatch them. And that gives you an incorrect sense of depth if you mismatch the images. So this is the veridical answer, but you could get all kinds of false answers that mean different depths. That's why when you're riding on escalators, you sometimes miss your step, because the slats on an escalator can misfuse in the two eyes. I think that the post-impressionists and some of the impressionists figured this out. You know how they talked about painting the air? I think they did that by having little dabs of paint that could be mismatched in your two eyes. So these are paintings that when you look at them with two eyes, you get this weird sense of a volume that's filled with speckles. And in this painting, I don't even like to look at it because it makes this weird three-dimensionality that undulates kind of unpleasantly for me. But the guy who painted it, Klimt, didn't see it. He could not have seen that weird sense of three-dimensionality because he was stereo blind. How do I know? Look at him. This eye is looking right at you. This eye is looking at me. He's stereo blind. He's cross-eyed. You can't have stereo unless the right parts of the visual field end up in the same part of your visual cortex, because it's a computation that happens early in the visual system, and it requires the two retinal images to be aligned. So if your eyes are crossed or wall-eyed when you're a little kid, you never get stereopsis. So I got interested in this question of talent and what makes a good artist when I was doing some research on dyslexia. So dyslexia is a specific problem in learning how to read. Otherwise, perfectly intelligent children have a really difficult time learning to read, despite normal instruction. And I find that equiluminant text is difficult to read. So that said something to me about, well, maybe there's something funny about processing in the visual system in people with dyslexia. So, remember the WARE system: motion, depth, spatial organization, and figure ground segregation. Well, what are the symptoms of dyslexia besides a problem learning to read? Well, kids with dyslexia often see things reversed, positional information problems, they have problems with figure ground segregation, and they have trouble gauging distance and depth. They also have trouble, the same kinds of trouble, in the auditory system. And as I was doing this research on dyslexia, I was privileged to meet a large number of dyslexics. And it was obvious that a huge number of people with dyslexia are very talented artists, actors, computer programmers, bet you're some of that there, and musicians. And the usual, and people know this. The school system knows that the dyslexic population is overrepresented in the arts. And the usual explanation is they're bad at reading, so they tend to congregate in the art room. But some of these people were so talented that I had to consider the possibility that there's something about their brain organization that makes them better at these things than those of us who are very good at reading. So with music, you might consider the fact that they have trouble with ba and da, so they have trouble with phonetics. Ba and da, the difference happens over 40 milliseconds. It's a timing problem. And maybe that's what makes them better at music, because they're better at the slower transitions rather than the fast transitions. Oh, I was going to say this. So what about art? Why are there so many artists who are dyslexic? Well, maybe it's something really dumb, like trouble gauging distance and depth. So I couldn't draw a chair if my life depended on it, because I have this internal representation from my information processing that the chair is three-dimensional and I can't flatten it. But what if a kid already sees the world as flat? It's easy for him to draw a chair without any trouble. Maybe that gets him started down the road of becoming an artist. And what's the first thing you learn in drawing one? Flatten the world, close one eye. I learned that from an art teacher. So we looked at some famous artists to find out if artists are often stereo blind. So I told you 10% of otherwise normal people are stereo blind. And you can tell that someone is stereo blind by looking at their eyes. So this is Chuck Close, fabulous artist. If you look at his glasses, you can see that he is anisometropic, that is, his eyes are a different degree of myopia. He has terrible depth perception. He's also severely dyslexic. You can tell if somebody's eyes are lined up by looking at the light reflection, the white spot, the light reflex. If it's in the same spot in the two eyes, the eyes are aligned, and they could at least have stereo. It isn't guaranteed that they have stereo, but they could, okay? You see the light reflex, same place in the two eyes? Are you good at this? Okay, you know how to do it? There's one baseball player who is known to have had no stereopsis. This is Babe Ruth. Do you see the light reflex is centered in his left eye, but it's off to the side in his right eye? He's wall-eyed, right? So 3% of the population has significantly misaligned eyes, so misaligned that you know they have no stereopsis and you can pick it up in a photograph. This is a legitimate clinical test. It's called the Hirschberg test. So we looked at a bunch of famous artists. We looked at 52 famous artists. And from that statistic, you'd expect that we'd find one or two of them who were stereo blind. We found 16. This is Kara Walker. Do you see where the light reflex is in one eye? Completely different spot in the other eye. Kara Walker works in silhouettes. How flat can you get? Andrew Wyeth is wall-eyed. His father is also wall-eyed and is an illustrator. Was, I'm sure. Edward Hopper is wall-eyed. I have a bunch of pictures of Picasso because that's when he was young, and I don't know about the dog. Marc Chagall is cross-eyed. Frank Stella is cross-eyed. Jasper Johns is wall-eyed. Robert Rauschenberg is wall-eyed and severely dyslexic. Alexander Calder is wall-eyed. Man Ray. Now, as I said, it is a legitimate clinical test to take a photograph of somebody and see that their eyes are misaligned. You're not allowed really technically to do this with a painting, because obviously you could paint the right eye on Wednesday and the left eye on Thursday. But in the same trip to Paris, I was in a room at the Louvre, had four Rembrandt self-portraits. Every single one of them, his eyes were misaligned. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting. So you have one eye looking straight ahead and the other eye looking to the side. And I know that you paint a self-portrait by looking at the mirror, and if you hold the mirror up, you're looking to the right to paint your right eye and to the left to paint your left eye. So I made a montage of myself with a mirror 8 inches from my face, looking at my right eye and my left eye, and indeed my eyes are not quite lined up, but they're nowhere near as misaligned as Rembrandt portrays himself. So you can say, is it always the same eye? Because if it was always the same eye, then it might be real. Otherwise, it could be just something stylistic. And no, it wasn't always the same eye. Sometimes it's the eye on this side of the painting, and sometimes it's the eye on that side. And I have a young colleague who is himself a stereo blind artist, and Bevel said, Marge, you have to separate it into the paintings and the etchings. So when I did that, in the paintings, it's always this eye that deviates off. In the etchings, it's always this eye. And the way you make an etching, for you modern people, is you scratch on a plate and then you flip it over. So that's why his eyes, the deviating eye, was reversed. And so we made a program in Adobe where you figure out where the eye is centered in the palpebral fissure, and we made a graph. And if you can make a graph of something, you know this, right? If you can make a graph of something, you can get it published in the most unlikely places. This got published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And in all the paintings we examined, the eye looking straight ahead was always the eye on the right, and the other eye deviated. It was the reverse in the etchings. We think this is evidence that this painting in Berlin is a fake. Or he made it from an etching. Don't know which. So, these are the take-home messages we're going to get here. The most important one is vision is information processing. And if you're going to interface with a biological entity, you need to deal with that, okay? Or you might as well just write equations. Vision is parallel. There are different jobs for different subdivisions of our visual system, and some of the most fundamental and evolutionarily old and emotionally relevant parts of our visual system are completely colorblind. They're like black and white photography. Color is coarse. You don't have to color inside the lines. And people's brains are different. And something that makes you good in one job may make you bad in another, and vice versa. But you don't need to poke an eye out to make your kid artistic. Just close one eye, okay? And if you would you mind leaving the stereo glasses on your way out of the room on the... Where can I tell them to put them? Somewhere out there. Or to the people with the red vests. And I'd be happy to answer questions, and I'm sorry if I went into your coffee break.